I'm Britt Garner. I'm a science teacher in New York City.
And I'm Rob Spall, the head of communications at IPBES, the world's biodiversity platform for science and policy.
Welcome to Nature Insight.
Speed dating with the future.
We did it again, Rob. It is bittersweet to be at the end of another season, but I am so thankful to have had another season of Nature Insight shared with you and our team here.
Britt, six episodes just flies. And for the last 5 weeks, we've been introducing our listeners to some of the extraordinary individuals who are part of the wider IPBES community and who work on the front lines of research, policy, and action for nature.
They've helped us share key insights into the relationship between humans and the rest of the natural world to help us all understand more about the incredible values of nature.
Britt, let's hope that by next season, we'll be able to share exciting sounds of adventures in some faraway places.
Yes, please.
In the meantime, this is the most exciting sound I could find in my current environment. Although, after 2 years of working from home, the sound of our clanky copier is actually a welcome sign that my work ecosystem has shifted again.
Fair enough.
You know, in spite of the COVID challenges, though, you had a total habitat change.
I really did. You might remember that I moved about 2,000 miles east from Montana to New York at the beginning of August. Now, in the beginning of season one, I was howling with the wolves of the human Missoula variety. Every night to show appreciation for our frontline workers. And nowadays, these are the sounds I'm more likely to hear outside of my window.
That seems like a huge change.
It is, and yet somehow nothing's changed at all. We have humans and we have non-humans, and both are making sounds back and forth, sometimes in tandem, sometimes missing each other entirely. Both of these environments are nature, just in completely different manifestations and species and types.
But I think too often we see nature as being quite separate, quite apart from our own lives. And if there's one thing that all of the interviews we've done on Nature Insight have left with me, it's the importance of looking at the values of nature through as many sets of eyes and from as many perspectives as possible.
Yes, yes, and yes. Granted, I am biased, having graduated with a degree in interdisciplinary sciences, but I really do agree. I don't know how we can possibly begin to look at these complicated topics without inter- and multidisciplinary work.
Britt, speaking of interdisciplinary, our guest for this final episode of season two is Steve Pulaski. He's a professor of ecological and environmental economics at the University of Minnesota.
Environment and economics. Now, a man after my own heart, being someone who tries to combine musical theater and science all the time. Indeed, these, you know, are two areas of studies we don't usually see aligned. And yet, Steve really wanted to stress that they don't exist in isolation from each other at all.
That's right. And he spent the best part of his long career figuring out how exactly they are interconnected. So I started by asking him what it was like when he first brought those two fields together more than 20 years ago.
When I first started on this, it was a little bit like dropping into warring factions and, and you know, being an economist in a room full of conservationists and conservation biologists and ecologists, it's sometimes had the feeling like I was coming over from the dark side. I have to say that this is totally changed. I think there has been a welcome recognition that if we are going to successfully navigate the 21st century, where humans have such a large impact on nature, that we in fact need to align ecology and economics, or more broadly, kind of the social sphere and the natural sphere.
You were also one of the coordinating lead authors on the IPBES Global Assessment, and that study found that the changes we're going to need for sustainability have to cut across different systems. We've talked a bit about the study of the environment and the economy. How about the actual crises, the nature crises and economics? Are those overlapping?
Absolutely. If you think about how it is that we are, we meaning humans, are affecting the environment, a lot of this comes through our economic activity, you know, how we choose to live and make our livings. So, you know, everything from the emissions of greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels to run our industry and our cars and airplanes and so on, to how we grow our food and changing land use, which changes habitat for other species. So recognition of how we are using and changing nature in kind of running our daily affairs, running our economy, is essential, because otherwise we won't recognize how to change what we're doing or modify what we're doing and align it with the forces of nature rather than working against it, and use this to sustain our livelihoods rather than destroying the vital infrastructure on which it depends.
So looking after nature is not just about saving cuddly critters, right? It really is also about safeguarding our own well-being.
That's exactly it. There was this notion out there that conservation activities were nice but unessential. Mm-hmm. These were frills. It would be great to save the polar bears, and wouldn't we all feel good about doing so? It is great to save the polar bears, don't get me wrong, but this is not just about saving the cute, cuddly critters out there. This is about saving the vital infrastructure on which our economy and our well-being ultimately depends. I mean, we don't have an economy on Mars. We have an economy on Earth. We depend on Earth systems to support us.
I remember reading, I think it was either a World Economic Forum report or a UN report, about the extent to which nature loss is putting economies at risk. And I think the number was that there's more than half of global GDP that is either moderately or highly dependent on nature.
Yeah, and in some ways, as striking as that figure is, it's probably an underestimate. Mm. These are things which relatively directly depend on nature, you know, so obviously growing food or timber or harvesting fish, those are things which clearly depend directly on nature. But put our economy on Mars, we don't have an economy. So ultimately, basically, all of the economy rests on Earth systems and the processes of Earth. So I think almost all industries recognize that nature impacts them at most one or two steps removed.
One of the things we've spoken a bit about this season in Nature Insight is the different kinds of values of nature. And some people really object to the idea of giving nature an economic value, arguing perhaps that that's a way of commodifying nature. Why do we need to place an economic value on nature?
There is a real issue here, which I want to address, but I also want to kind of broaden this out. I think there is sometimes a narrow notion of what economic value means, and it gets confused with market value and things which are bought and sold. What economic value to an economist like myself who studies the environment is, it's anything that people value, that gives value to people. So even saving the polar bears that we talked about earlier is a type of an economic value. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, you know, if again, we come back to this vital notion of the Earth providing kind of the underpinning of the economy, the vital infrastructure, if you will, then placing an economic value on nature is trying to make visible the invisible. It's trying to show, in fact, how nature contributes in vital ways to our well-being. And that's the kind of the notion of bringing economic value to nature or placing an economic value to nature, which I think is vitally important to successfully going forward with economics and our whole society going into the 21st century. So now I did say at the start, there is a notion that, you know, people talk about the danger of commodifying nature and the narrow notion of, does it have a market value or not? Many things in nature do not have market values. And so, you know, to financial systems, to economic systems right now, they don't appear to be worth anything. And of course, that's not true. They have value. It's just that it doesn't show up in our current economic and financial accounting.
When you say a market value, can you make that real for us, for those of us who are not economists?
Let's use the example of suppose I do my own housework, right? Mm-hmm. So if I take care of my kids and I wash the floors and I cook dinner and I do that all myself, that doesn't get bought and sold in a market. There's no market transaction. The government has no record of this. From the official accounting standpoints, this has no value. I mean, it doesn't show up in the economic accounts. If I hire a cook and a nanny and I now pay them to take care of my kids and cook dinner, now that is a market transaction and it shows up as having value. Well, it's the same thing with the environment. The environment supplies us numerous things for free, mm-hmm. you know, filtering yeah. out water pollutants or air pollutants, you know, providing clean water, providing pollination to our crops, providing soil fertility. All of this is done in a way for free. And the economic system doesn't pick up on this value. But of course, it is valuable.
So the idea of making the invisible visible, I think that makes a lot of sense. Steve, I mean, one of the things I learned about when I did basic economics at university was the impacts of things like the Great Depression, for instance, in the 1930s. I know you talk about something that you call the Great Degradation. What does that actually mean?
Part of the IPBES report documented how we have changed nature over the last 50, 100 years. But focusing on the last 50 years, my part of the IPBES study showed that we have changed nature in a way that has led to a decline in the majority of what are called nature's contributions to people. A majority of the ways that nature contributes valuable goods and services to people, right? Contributions to clean air, clean water, climate stabilization, protection from storms, protection from pests, regulating pests and pathogens. So the great degradation of nature is that we have systematically changed nature, altered its processes in ways that are harmful to our own well-being. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the great degradation of nature. The analogy with the Great Depression is that we didn't always have something called GDP, gross domestic product, or system of economic accounting. That grew out of the notion in the Great Depression and also in the run-up to World War II that governments needed statistics to know how to manage the economy. How was it doing? What types of policies really were needed? So there was a sense that governments were kind of flying blind. They didn't have the kind of information that they needed to manage our economic affairs. And the Great Depression certainly brought that to the forefront. Well, now we're kind of flying blind through this great degradation of nature. And we vitally need statistics and information to show how what we're doing is affecting nature, which ultimately affects our own well-being.
I remember the very stark images that we learned about, again, about the Great Depression, of these massive dust bowls and the storms and the impacts of very much the human activity on the natural world. So clearly, we're seeing an even greater element of that in the Great Degradation. So if we got GDP from the Great Depression, what's the statistical equivalent that we want from the Great Degradation?
So the thing that we have been really striving to do is to do what you talked about earlier of making the invisible visible. So showing how nature's processes, ecosystem processes, lead to contributions of which we value. Mm-hmm. So I've been working on something with colleagues from the Chinese Academy of Sciences called Gross Ecosystem Product, or GEP. Okay, so and it's meant to basically parallel GDP, but to do so in a way that recognizes what the true values of nature are. So how is it that nature is contributing to recharging groundwater or providing surface water flows, preventing floods, contributing to filtering out air pollutants or preventing dusts, so sandstorms, all of those variety of ways in which nature contributes to people. Mm-hmm. And doing so in a way which building on good ecological and earth system science, so understanding how these processes work, but then translating them into how is it affecting people? In what ways does it contribute to well-being?
Okay, so economists really enjoy putting numbers on things. Let's try and put a number on that idea then. If you have GDP in a particular circumstance and you then want to look at GDP compared to gross ecosystem product, GEP, can you make that real for us?
Yeah, so we did a study in China in one of the provinces in western China called Qinghai Province. It's up on the Tibetan Plateau. It's also known as the water tower of Asia because it's the headwaters of the Yangtze River, the Yellow River, and the Mekong River. So three very, very large river systems. And we did a study of GEP and compared that to GDP measures. So we valued the contributions that Qinghai makes to water resources, both there and downstream, the difference that it makes in terms of being able to stabilize soils to prevent sandstorms downwind. And we showed, in fact, that GEP was of similar magnitude to GDP. And in particular, that it wasn't just the production of crops or of livestock, which kind of one thinks about kind of directly as contributing to the economy, but it was really through these regulating water supplies, providing clean water, preventing erosion of soil and sandstorms. Those were the things that actually were contributing large values and made this GEP significant.
So let's change gears a little bit. Last year, there was a report by United Nations Environment Program and the World Economic Forum, and it said that solutions from nature can play a huge role in addressing both the climate and biodiversity crises, but that there's still a massive financing gap somewhere in the region of about $4.1 trillion by 2050. What incentives are there for private sector investment in nature and nature-based solutions?
So there are certainly some. I don't want to say that there is none. So, for example, an industry that depends upon water supply from a local river will have some incentive. But there is a real problem here, which is oftentimes talked about as the tragedy of the commons, where we don't pay attention to what is jointly or commonly providing for our welfare. So even in that river system, a particular industry isn't the only one who controls actions that happen in that river system. There's lots of actions taken by lots of different businesses or different households that affect things. And you know, if I just care about my little portion of things, say, well, I'm just a small cog in a big wheel. I'm a small player here. And if everybody takes that attitude, of course, nobody protects the resource. So we don't do well on those kinds of public goods. So there's a huge role for the private sector to play, but there's also a role for public-private partnerships. We need to have incentive schemes or policies in place that basically provide incentives for protecting these public goods, conserving these public goods, rather than destroying them. People have talked about putting a price on carbon so that companies and households are rewarded for emitting less greenhouse gas, or that they have to pay for the privilege of emitting greenhouse gases. And that's can be thought of then more broadly in the environment. So, you know, paying farmers to provide clean water downstream or habitat, rather than rewarding them strictly for growing corn or soybeans that end up polluting the water or destroying habitat.
In your research that you've done and the years of work that you've done with the financial sector, have you seen a change in how much appetite there is for these kinds of specific actions?
Yes, absolutely. Say 20 years ago, or you know, at the same time we had the sort of warring factions of environmentalists and economists, there was a feeling in the business sector that this was extraneous to them. But I think there has been a fundamental awakening that ultimately the economic sector, business health depends on having a healthy planet. So, you know, we first saw this in the climate arena, where many of the progressive businesses, forward-thinking businesses, woke up to the fact that this was going to have an impact. Certainly, it's already starting to have impact. It will have more of an impact in the future, and that they needed to take this into account in their operations and in their planning. I think there is now a broader recognition that it's not strictly the climate, that even if we fix the climate problem, if we don't address these other nature's contributions to people, if we don't think about these other ways that we're affecting the planet through land use, through water use, through management of soil and management of biodiversity, that that similarly poses risks to businesses and their operations. You know, maybe they've got a facility which is on a vulnerable coastline, or, you know, they're dependent on crops in an area that's the soil is becoming less fertile. I think there's been a pivot from kind of just focusing on the climate problem to also focusing on kind of, if I will, the nature problem that we need to sustain natural capital in order to have a healthy economy.
So clearly you've seen a change over time in how much appetite there is. Have you had any specific instances that you can share with us?
Yeah, let me give you a very recent example. So at the beginning of December, there was a meeting that was organized by the Central Bank of Mexico that invited central banks from other countries. And one of the keynote speakers was Hank Paulson, who is former chairman of Goldman Sachs and was the Secretary of the Treasury in the U.S. for a while. So, you know, these are top-level people. And the point of this meeting was, in fact, how we need to bring nature, you know, kind of nature's accounts into the financial accounts, into the central banks, into the operations of these financial organizations. So, you know, here you have the very top of the financial industry and of central bankers recognizing that this is truly an important topic.
Mm-hmm. How much of that do you think filters down from the top executive levels within the private sector to perhaps the more operational managers who are really having to implement changes?
I think we've got a huge gap still. If you think about sort of stages of effectively dealing with problems, the first stage is recognition, and we're starting through that phase. We're still there. Then there's translating that recognition into action. And I think in terms of kind of day-to-day operations, even companies that want to do well by nature, there's kind of a lack of understanding and lack of practice for how actually to do it. Let's say a mid-level bank manager who's looking at their loan portfolio and they're asking themselves, well, what should I be doing in terms of affecting these loans, you know, whether to give these loans or what conditions to put on these loans? There's a real lack of kind of operational day-to-day translation of what it means to value nature and how that's going to affect that mid-level bank manager. So I think the next decade is vital for translating kind of recognition and high-level statements into actions so that we start having business live as if nature mattered.
If you could share one message about the links between nature and the economy, what would that be?
That properly understood, this is all really one system. That there is no separate economic accounting and environmental accounting. That properly understood, natural capital, the nature's contributions to people, this is already internal or should be central to business and financial and economic accounting and business and financial incentives.
So economics is not separate from nature.
Or nature is not separate from economics, yes.
Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Rob.
Oh, I love that. Nature is not separate from economics.
Nope, not at all. As Steve mentioned, there are actually some financial institutions, not enough of them, of course, but nonetheless, some of them are waking up to the importance of including nature in their operations and their planning. So I thought it would be good for us to hear from one of the organizations that does.
Oh, awesome. Well, who'd you get to talk to for that?
So I reached out to BNP Paribas, one of the biggest banking groups in the world, and had a quick chat with Delphine Glusman. She's in charge of the environment section at BNP Paribas Foundation. Now, that's the philanthropic arm of the group. They say they're aiming to mobilize 3 billion euro in financing for the protection of biodiversity. So we started by talking about the financing gaps which also exist in the philanthropic world.
In fact, if we looked at figures, what we can see is that less than 2% of global philanthropic giving is dedicated to climate change mitigation, and even less so for biodiversity.
And to understand this gap, she explained that we need to look at history, because people really are used to giving money to social or health-related causes, and in those areas, philanthropy has had some decent impact, but not so much with nature-related issues.
People go specifically to causes that they know, that are close to them, and environment is a quite new topic in the area of philanthropy. And biodiversity is less known than other sectors. And I'm totally convinced that we can extend this effort to sustainable development and especially to the preservation of biodiversity and its habitats.
This idea was really quite intuitive to me, that the flow of money would naturally go to more established causes that perhaps people understand.
Oh, of course. I mean, that which we are closest to tends to be that which we care about and which we understand and speak about and is closest to home. And those are really the things that, when it comes to finance, we might be most readily available or most easily available to actually give to.
Sure. As Delphine pointed out, a rather obvious solution: show people the impact of loss of biodiversity, loss of nature, on their daily lives, and they'll care more about it and be willing to give more.
I think we have to raise awareness to more people to understand why working on biodiversity is crucial for the society globally.
BNP Paribas is actually the first foundation to have funded some of our work here at IPBIS directly. And Delphine mentioned this when she talked about the value of the science that IPBIS has been gathering in helping guide their decision-making and decision-making of other elements and organizations in the private sector.
The tools that you design can help us develop the best practices to preserve biodiversity. It was totally natural for us to partner with you and to support financially your work that will serve at the end of the day the public interest.
And so much of this goes back also to what Steve was talking about, the fact that the economy that we care about is the economy on Earth, not somewhere else. I mean, it's a really important point, because this is what we've got. This is what we've got to work with. This is what we've got to live with. He talked about, in the beginning of his career, dropping into these warring factions between economics and ecology and biology. And the reality is that I think that that war has really become much more of an understanding, and there's been a detente that's been reached with the idea that both sides need each other and that maybe there are no two sides, that it's ultimately the same side.
Yeah, and just like the idea of nature itself being socially constructed, I mean, same with these things, any of these realms. They aren't truly these walled, you know, cities without interaction with each other. It really is a fluid motion and more of an ecosystem. Amazing ecosystem, economic. Oh, I should grab my tinfoil hat. I think I'm onto something.
Speaking of the great invisible, this idea that Steve had of making the invisible values of nature visible in our economic systems, actually it echoes so many of the discussions that we've had this season.
Totally.
The discussions about, you know, how can you use law, which usually is invisible, in a more powerful way? How can you look at the idea of wild species and find out how important they are to each of us in ways that we just don't normally see? So making that invisible visible, it's almost a theme for the season.
Yes. And we got, within this episode, this idea of flying blind through the great degradation of nature. I mean, that's a lot to take in. And yet, yeah. I think I feel actually quite hopeful considering the conversations we've been able to have. And I'm curious, Rob, you know, how do you think IPBIS is able to help? Is IPBIS actually embarking on some kind of an assessment or project actually digging into this idea of business and biodiversity?
So we are. There are a number of different projects in the pipeline, but the one that's most specific to business in the private sector is an assessment that will begin within weeks of us recording this episode, looking at the links between business and biodiversity, and looking at how those links go in both directions, how business is dependent on nature and nature's contributions, and how nature affects business. So that new assessment will be a 3-year process, and perhaps in 3 years from now, in a future season, we'll be able to share some findings from that.
Very, very cool. and thinking of seasons in years to come. I know for me, this season was really special, not only to get the band back together, but to really think about what it means to be an educator, working with youth every day now for me as a teacher, and thinking about hope when I'm in a room with students whose generation actually is at the highest existential threat to the idea of the loss of biodiversity or massive effects from climate change. It's just really humbling, and yet kind of gave me this glimmer of light to bring into the classroom when talking about these massive topics.
Well, hopefully it's not just light for a classroom, but light for all sorts of different environments and elements. You know, for me, Britt, I get to work with IPBIS on a daily basis, and I sometimes forget how important some of the relatively regular things that we're doing are. So The first episode of our season this time around, where we were talking about the fellowship program, this is something which is the daily bread and butter of the work that IPBIS does. But to hear it from the perspectives of Lilani and some of the other people who've been involved gives you fresh ideas, fresh perspectives around these sorts of things. And then at the other end of the spectrum, getting to talk to people like Michelle Lim about some really new things for me, you know, the power and the limits of law to protect nature. It's been a really memorable season.
It really has. And I'm just so thankful to have been a part of it once again.
That's a wrap on this second season of Nature Insight. Thanks again to Steve Pulaski and to Delphine Glisman for helping us close this season.
And a huge thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us on these weekly speed dates with the future. If you haven't already done so, make sure to go back and listen to the great interviews from season one.
And if you'd like to stay in touch with IPBIS's work as we prepare the next season, head to our website at www.ipbis.net. or follow us on any of our social media channels. Just search for @IPBES. We'll be back with season 3 of Nature Insight. Hope you'll join us then.